All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, talking to you from New York City on this, the 23rd day of April, 2019. I'd like to always remind you that I write a newsletter called Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks. You can sign up for that by going to miningstocks.com. miningstocks.com, and also like to encourage you to consider subscribing to Chen Lin's letter, What is Chen Buying? What is Chen Selling? ChenPicks.com, Chen, ChenPicks.com, it's a place to go for that. Of course, Michael Oliver is with us, and we'll be talking to him shortly, and OliverMSA.com, OliverMSA.com is the place to go to sign up for Michael's excellent work. I do want to thank all of you for listening to the show, making it one of the more popular shows on the Voice America Business Channel, and encourage you to continue sending along your comments, whatever they may be, to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com, questions4taylor@gmail.com. And, of course, we do want to thank our sponsors for making the show economically viable. This week's sponsors are RN Resources, Great Bear Resources, Klondike Gold, Marimont Resources, Novo Resources, and Strike Point Gold. I've titled today's show, Why Do Rich Capitalists Suggest Destruction of Capitalism? Jeff Dice, Eric Coffin, and as I noted, Michael Oliver are with me today. Many billionaires, like Ray Dalio, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, among them, like to call for higher taxes on people such as themselves. But this raises a compelling question. Would they have become rich in the first place under the kind of tax system that they now advocate? Would they have accumulated a critical mass of investment capital if taxes had consumed more of their profits along the way? Would they have been able to maintain sufficient capital expenditures in their respective businesses to stay dynamic? Or would revenue capital and personal wealth lost to the IRS have relegated these super achievers to the status of merely successful? Well, Jeff Dice will come along with some of his thoughts on that, on those questions. And Eric Coffin, he's going to be with me once again. We haven't spoken to Eric in quite some time. He'll be with me during the second segment after our first commercial break. And then we are privileged, as we are almost every week, to have Michael Oliver with us right now. Thanks for joining me, Michael.
Hi, Jay. Interesting day.
It is an interesting day, indeed. And, you know, with gold getting weaker again this week and the dollar getting stronger, it's not surprising that many gold bugs are really discouraged. A longtime listener and subscriber to my newsletter named John sent an email that was fairly detailed, but for the sake of brevity, it can be boiled down to the following question, I believe. He says, why in the world would anyone want to add gold and gold shares to their portfolios when the government and bankers who have all the power and despise the competition that gold gives their fiat currency game and conspire against gold price discovery by slamming its price in the paper markets? Why would anybody ever want to own gold and gold shares? It just looks like the rig is up and there's no chance for us gold bucks. So what is your response to the notion that government and bankers, first of all, that they have the power to suppress the gold price?
Well, maybe from time to time, but you got to realize gold is not like trading cow manure or corn or something like that. It's money. Okay, so therefore governments are involved in the market. And on the other side of the balance, who's complaining about government buying of gold? China, Russia, Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody seems to complain about that sort of intervention, quote unquote. They're buying gold for solid reasons. Now maybe there are governments or government agencies or banks related to central banks that are trying to apply negative pressure in the gold market for whatever reason. Yeah. But, you know, I remember back in the bull market from 1976, gold was $103.50 at the August 1976 low, and it reached over $800 in 1980. In the middle of that bull market, late 70s, the IMF was dumping gold by the tons, acting as representative for various governments. And I remember the first several dumpings of gold that they had, and this is in the cash market, obviously, but it's the same thing. Gold responded negatively, sharply, you know, $50 down days, that kind of thing. But after a while, gold said, you know, so what, and ate them up so that they would have auctions and there would be no dip at all. So there's a reality out there, an objective reality that exists in the world. And sometimes it might be distorted by folks who think they can intervene, and this includes governments and central banks, and intervene successfully over time. Well, they may be able to get away with it at certain points in time, particularly if they might be technically appropriate times. But then when it's technically inappropriate or the fundamentals have really compressed themselves to the point where they're defying reality, they'll be steamrolled. It's happened many times. If central banks were always potent, we wouldn't have stock market crashes like we did in 2008. They fought it all the way down. They didn't succeed in stopping it. They're potent up to a point, then they become totally impotent. And when that becomes revealed to investors, that they're impotent, and of course we've had 10 years now of their apparent potency, so the belief structure is pretty strong on their favor.
Right.
But when it comes unwound, it's a terrific wound ripping, and I think that's where we are right now. Now, in the case of gold, all I can say is if they control gold and didn't want it to go up, how come we're not at 1160 where we were last August?
Right.
How come we're not 1045 where we were late 2015? How come gold went from $1,000 to 1920 between 2009 and 2011? So obviously they don't control things all the time. So I think that to some extent that's just cocktail conversation stuff, and I dismiss it. You have to be in gold. It is a reality.
No, it certainly is. Well, certainly, you know, I'm remembering the early 2000s, gold was 250 and it rose all the way. I think it had 10 years in a row it was higher. Went up to 1900, and then we've had the smackdown from 2011. Michael, you got your subscribers in early 2016. We saw a nice rise up, and now we've seen quite a correction. Do you think you think it's about over now?
I think so. You know, I won't. We deal with numbers, so I have the sort of a macro view overarching it, but I never let that get in the way. We've been major bearish on gold. You know, back in 2011, 2012, we stayed bearish till 2016. So we can flip, okay. But right now we're bullish. So far the break has not gotten down to levels that would cause us any concern. Now I'll admit this, it's about 1.5% below where we reached today. But our short-term stuff, now we usually look at long-term momentum technical indicators, they're all positive. But the short-term stuff obviously was negative during the decline. It had to be.
Sure.
But it all looks aligned now such that if you get a day up in gold at this point forward, you know, $5 or $10, all the short-term stuff that we keep is flipping up with clean structure. Now, you cannot see it on a price chart, but when you look at the momentum charts, they're very clear dynamics with minor upside from current levels. Now remember, June gold's right now about 1273. The settlement today would be about 1273.30. Becomes the front month contract after April expires on Friday. If we see gold upper, you know, upper 1270s or 1280 late this week, early next week, as far as I'm concerned, the turn's underway.
Well, it doesn't seem like too much to accomplish.
No, it's not much to accomplish, but put it this way. In early March and in late March, there were two significant lows in gold, one just above 1280, one just below 1280. Where's gold right now? 1273 on the June contract.
Right.
Where's the disaster? Where's the disaster? it's taken out a bunch of price lows, which no doubt causes people to pull their hair out, but it's all of, you know, 0.5% or less below the lows of early March. Let's see it then. You know, if the bears are in charge, let's knock the hell out of it. Let's go down $50. They're not doing it. They're doing it in $5 increments. So I think they're wasting their ammo, and I think we might be at a pivot point here. And if we see a minor upturn, we'll be screaming. So
I suspect that part of the disaster in the minds of many people is they feel left out. If they're in gold and gold shares and they're out of the equity market continues to go up, it seemingly almost every day. With just a minute and a half left here, Michael, could you put the equity market in perspective, the S&P 500 specifically?
There's two equity markets. We like the emerging markets. They're more commodity related. They went down from 2011 through 2016 big time. They went down percent-wise, while the S&P was still being inflated by central banks, as are most of the developed markets. In context, if you ran a pension fund right now, you're barely up over the last year or so in the S&P. Yes, from the December low, it's been a nice rally, but it's redundant action. We're where we were last September. We're a percent or so above where we were January a year ago. So from the point of view of accumulating wealth over a span of now a year and a quarter, you're barely up. Yes, it's had a big rally, but it's been a rally from great depths. So you're getting a lot of redundant overlapping price action, which in our view, after 10, now 11 years of upside, is probably indicative, highly indicative, of topping action. New highs in this index or that index don't impress us. Now, in emerging markets, different story. They underwent a major bear market, so they're free to have a bull market now. They're fresh. They're coming from in-depth flows. They weren't supported by central banks. The Chinese government didn't keep Shanghai Composite from dropping from 5,200 to 2,400 in 3.5 years. They didn't stop it. They allowed it to occur. So its upturn is fresh. So totally different from the developed markets. So I think you have to sort of stand back and look at the charts, broader context.
Sure. Well, certainly looking at previous tops like, you know, 2000 or 1987, they took quite a while. I mean, these things are, you know, you, really, some of those tops that take quite a while, don't they, before you finally get some resolution?
They take at least a year, and quite often there's another new high, like October of 2007. Fed generated that high deliberately. Everybody acknowledged they did. They drove it from the August low of 2007 up a couple hundred points in the S&P, which back then was more significant than it is now, made a new high, and it fell apart. So this one happens to be a bit broader, in about a quarter wider in terms of time spent laboring. And it might make a new high. In fact, we suggested a month or so ago that if you might even go up to 3,000 on the S&P, which is to say a couple percent higher than the September high of last year. But it looks like a big widening topping pattern, and we don't trust it. I think it is highly dangerous. I find other areas in the stock markets of the world to be. It makes sense, technically and fundamentally. This makes no sense. I think it's highly dangerous.
All right, we'll have to leave it go at that. So I guess the bottom line is you don't think now is the time to jump out of gold stocks and gold and buy the S&P 500.
No, man.
After 11 years.
That's my worst friend.
Okay. All right, thanks so much, Michael, for being with us again, and we'll look to do it again next week, hopefully. All right, folks, well, we do have to go to break now, but don't go away because Eric Coffin is going to be with me, and Eric always has some very good insights into what's happening in the economic sphere and specifically also in the junior exploration market, so don't go away. We'll be right back with Eric Coffin.
Noble Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Karratha region of Western Australia, where they are currently drilling and trenching their Perdies Reward Project. In addition, Noble has partnered with Sumitomo Mining Corporation to advance its Beaton's Creek Gold Project toward production. With over $70 million in cash and strong shareholder support from the likes of Kirkland Lake Gold, Noble is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.
Great Bear Resources, trading under GBR on the TSX and GTBDF on the OTCQB, is a gold exploration company focused on their wholly owned Dixie Project in the prolific Red Lake Mining District of Ontario, Canada. Recent drill results yielded an impressive 1,600 grams per ton gold over 0.7 meters near surface. GBR is fully funded to drill 300-plus holes this year. McEwen Mining is a significant shareholder following a $5.7 million investment as part of a recent $10 million financing. Visit greatbearresources.ca.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have Eric Coffin with me once again. It's been a while since Eric's been on the show. He had been a pretty frequent guest until recently. I don't know why we haven't had him on more often, but we certainly should, because he really has a lot of great insights into the equity markets, into the markets in general, and specifically in the junior exploration space, especially the early exploration stocks. I think he's as good as anyone that I know in sort of determining what the prospects are. He has a good grasp of geology and geological concepts, and knows everybody in Vancouver. Brent Cook tells me he keeps very well in touch with the people, the makers and the shakers in that little in that small cap market up there. Eric, thanks for joining me again.
Thanks for having me as always, Jay.
Yeah, it's really good to have you, because I know that we've got the Metals Investor Forum coming up here on May 24th and 25th. And I should mention to my listeners that if you're in the Vancouver area and would like to attend, you better sign up quickly, because that event usually sells out. And I don't know, Eric, how is it going this time? Is it the numbers coming in pretty good?
I don't think it'll be any different. I mean, we're a month away, and we're already. Yeah, we're not really that far from the RSVP level where Matt Bennett, who runs it, starts thinking about going to waiting list. We're not very far away, and we're still a month away from the convention.
Yeah, they usually shut the doors on some people, and so if you want to go there, if you want to get there, it doesn't cost you anything, but you do need to sign up, because there's limited space, and it just doesn't work to have more than so many people coming in there and taking advantage of the goodies. The real goodies are what you learn from the companies, but they also treat the people that go very, very well, I would suggest. And so, Eric, it's been a pretty tough time, as you know, all of us know, especially if you're in the early sector, if you're really looking at the early stage exploration stocks. We're almost at that point where a lot of them are having trouble getting a bid. So, what are your thoughts about the gold share markets, the markets in general? Let's say, why do you think gold is having such a tough time now?
I think it's just nobody's buying it because nobody's buying it. I guess I realize that's probably not a very useful explanation, but I think we've got to see the S&P roll over to really get any momentum going here. It's just retail investors in general, and it seems to be largely retail, strangely, on Wall Street. Mm-hmm. They simply don't see any risk. If you look at a lot of the forward-looking indicators in the U.S., they're not that cheery. I noticed that Morgan Stanley's Economic Surprise Index is as negative as it's been at any time in the last several years.
Wow.
But by the same token, the S&P is making new highs today. It seems to be, it feels very frothy. It feels very retail. A lot of sort of institutional / pro traders, I know a lot of them are selling. They're selling like crazy, actually. They're befuddled about how well the market's doing, and it's starting to make them really nervous. And me too. I mean, I don't have any problem with Wall Street going up. I mean, yippee-yahoo, but it's disconcerting to me that I can't see many really logical reasons for it. It just feels like straight-up Momo trading, and that rarely ends well, and I'm afraid this may be another case where it won't end well, but it not ending well will help the gold market partially because we'll see if that's possible, Fed policy get even looser. Bad months for Wall Street tend to be bad months for the U.S. dollar. That'll just be another impetus. And people start looking for somewhere to hide, and there's no interest rates to be had. It makes the argument for getting a little bit of bullion as a non-correlated asset. Even if you're not a gold bug, there's a lot of logic to buying it as a non-correlated asset when the equity markets start doing poorly.
Well, yeah, Danielle DiMartino Booth, who underscored the point that she's not a gold bug, but she still wants to have gold. So I think that's well, Eric,
I'm sort of a mining exploration guy. I've been fascinated by the process, and I love following exploration stocks. I wouldn't call myself a gold bug, but I can certainly see a lot of reasons why gold should head higher. I just think it needs some sort of an impetus, and the one obvious thing I see out there right now is New York rolling over. But to me, that's most likely to be the starting gun, if you will.
Yeah. Well, it certainly seems that at the late stages of these long bull markets, the retail guys are the last ones in, and they're the ones that usually get burned. And it seems to me what I see in the mornings a lot of times when the markets are opening here in New York, they start down sharply, and then they start to come back during the day. So somebody is going out overnight selling, and then who knows. But anyway, let's get to some of the stocks that you like a lot, because I think – you know, at times like this, when we're seeing the little guys get the heck beat out of them, you know, my friend Chen Lin, for example, is I just saw some remarks he made about Pretium. Now, Chen doesn't go in the early stage explorations like you do so much, Eric, but he likes to look at established companies, and he can't wait for them to get hit a little bit harder. He'd like to pick some up, and that's the way a lot of successful investors treat these kind of markets, as an opportunity. Of course, you have to have some dry powder to take advantage of it. Let's talk about one of them that I know you like a lot, and I do too. They're a sponsor of this show, Great Bear Resources. Certainly some phenomenal assays, and the stock, I guess we're looking at only 38 million shares at 284 Canadian. Earlier today, it's about a little over $110 million market cap, 80 million U.S., something like that. My question about that, Eric, is, you know, yes, okay, we've seen some numbers. We don't have a resource yet, and I think it would be premature. But what do you think about the scale of this target here? Has it got scale?
It's got a lot of scale, actually. If you look at the sort of the main feature, the main structure, if you want to call it that, on their project, which is basically the Dixie Syncline, mm-hmm. and the property name is also Dixie in Red Lake. It's a very large feature. There are a lot of these sort of D2 folds, and D2 is just deformation stage 2. This type of folding, and it's basically just an area of weakness that allows fluid flows to come up. That's what delivers the gold into the area where you're drilling. Those D2 folds, in combination with ultramafics, there's a couple of very large ultramafic dikes running through this thing. These things are all kind of mushed together, and that's kind of the classic combination for very high-grade gold shoots in Red Lake. The big thing that Great Bear's got three things going for it, in my mind. One is very large target scale. I mean, the area they're drilling now is tiny in relation to the whole structure. Most of this structure has never seen a drill hole or anything. There's a lot of work to be done just to find these targets. And you most of the time in Red Lake, you get these high-grade shoots. They don't usually have a lot of strike length. They might be 50, 100 meters long. Mm-hmm. But the key to Red Lake is these things go down for kilometers.
Right.
The original Red Lake mine, which is really what gave birth to Goldcorp, I think they've mined down to about 2.5 kilometers now, and it's still wide open. So the trick is to find these things, figure out how they dip, what the dip is, what the strike is, and what the plunge is, and those three things sort of define how it's going to go down vertically. Because mm-hmm. they're small targets, you need to figure out all those three things fairly well so that you can keep hitting it as you go deep. The second thing that Great Bear has going for it is a great geological team led by Bob Singh. Bob's got a ton of Red Lake experience. He knows how these deposits work. There's a lot of the other people working on the project are ex-Goldcorp people that drilled these things for years at the original mine, so they know exactly what they look like and how to chase them. The third thing it's got going for it is a fat bank account and a really tight share structure.
Yeah.
Because the thing with Red Lake, these type of deposits, you need to drill a lot of holes. There's no way around it. You got to drill tons and tons and tons of holes. And where a lot of small companies have a big problem with this deposit type is they end up diluting the hell out of themselves in order to raise money to drill the number of holes you need to do. Great Bear is in a very envious position that they raised a lot of money at you know, like $1.50, at $2.50 mm-hmm. with flow through. So they've got they started the drill program they're doing now with $15 million. Their drill costs are low because they're right in town. They got a great drill company doing the drilling for them. They just expanded the current program to 60,000 meters, which is probably 100 drill holes, something like that, 150 probably. Even after they're done that, they have enough money sitting in their bank account to basically do that much drilling again. And they've got probably $8 or $9 million in the money warrants, some of which I own, that'll all get exercised. So, and like you said, they've got like 35 million shares of it. So they're in a great position to just keep building this thing.
No, it's fantastic. Really one of the most exciting stories I've been involved with in some time. Because we don't have much time, West Haven Resources, one I have not followed. You recommended I did. I just didn't get on it quickly enough. I see the stock has come back quite a bit. Actually, it's cut in half since January, the start of the year. And I'm thinking maybe this is one I should take a look at again now at these levels.
I think it's a good time to look at it. I mean, it's an interesting project. It's only literally 2 hours from Vancouver. I've been to the property a couple of times. This is an area. The guy that founded the company is Gren Thomas, who some of your really long-time listeners may remember as the guy that founded Aber Resources, which made a famous diamond find and ended up being a large producing company. He's the guy that founded that. The discoverer of the diamond pipes, of course, is daughter Ira. She's not directly involved with West Haven, but I know for a fact he's a big shareholder. His son, Gareth, is the CEO. They've been working in this area now called the Spencer's Ridge Gold Belt for like 9 years. And you got to give these guys credit because through a really crap market, they kept moving the projects forward. It was usually Gren and Gareth writing the checks, which is why Gren owns almost 40% of the stock. He didn't get it for free. He bought it over the years. And it's a deceptive stock. They have 90 million shares out, but the float's actually not that large on this thing because there's Gren, the family, plethora fund, which is a very smart gold fund out of Holland. That group probably owns 60% of it. They made a really exciting epithermal discovery late last year. The two best drill holes were like 17 meters at 25 grams and 46 meters at 10 grams. I mean, it's an impressive property. The problem they have is there's 100 meters of overburden. There's no outcrop. They're basically prospecting with a drill and trying to figure it out. They put out more good holes, but the last set of holes was people's expectations were so high, they didn't meet the expectations. They weren't terrible holes, but people were expecting so much. They got whacked down to 60 cents yesterday. It's back to about 70 today. The holes they're drilling right now, there's two holes they're drilling on a target where they think their main zone has been shifted over. If those holes hit, they probably add another 400 or 500 meters of open strike length. And it's important to keep in mind that these guys have got a lot of other targets on this property, and this property, ironically, was not their primary property. The property they really want to drill is another one called Schooner. They drilled Shovelnose last year because there were so many forest fire closures. They couldn't drill at Schooner, so they drilled at Shovelnose instead, which had already been logged, so there was no trees to burn, basically. But they've got a great project set, really straight-up, great management team, very experienced. They should have raised more money late last year. Yours truly was bugging them too, but they didn't. But they did raise about $3 million about a month ago. They've got enough money to drill probably another 15,000 or 20,000 meters. So you know, there'll be a little bit of a lull here after they finish these holes. they'll wait for a breakup, and they're just finishing permitting a much larger set of drill pads. Then they'll be back at it doing a 15 or 20,000 meter program in the summer with two drill rigs. So the timing to actually look at it now is actually quite good.
It's a good time. You're in this All right, Eric, we're going to have to leave it go at that. We're out of time already. I know you wanted to talk about another one, Northern Shield Resources, 6.5 cents. It's obviously a very early story, but all I can tell my listeners is the best.
It's very, very. It's another epithermal system. They found it. Nobody knew it was there. They're right on the top, so they're not going to generate exciting numbers, but what interests me is it does have gold at surface, and it's very big. The system is very large.
Okay, well, the way for people to take advantage of this knowledge that Eric pulls together, and it really is very valuable, I must say. I always try to listen to Eric as much as I can when we go to these shows, but you can take advantage of that by subscribing to his service. It's HRA. Eric Coffin's HRA Advisors.com, right? It's the place to go?
Advisory.com.
All right, well, check it out and go there and sign up for Eric's letter. There's lots and lots of good stuff. He works very hard and has a lot of experience in this sector and very valuable. Thank you, Eric, for being with me again, and we have to do it more often. Thanks for being with us today.
Sure. Thanks for inviting me, Jay.
Alrighty. Well, folks, we do have to go to break, but don't go away. Jeff Deist is going to be with me, former chief of staff to Ron Paul, now the president of the Mises Institute. So don't go away. We'll be right back with Jeff Deist.
A gold rush has begun. Recently, three of the largest gold mining companies announced strategic acquisitions in the Yukon Territories. Ahead of them was a group who had already consolidated the key claims covering the historic Klondike Gold Rush into one company, aptly named Klondike Gold Corp. Led by a team of accomplished geoscientists, the company is steadily advancing exploration to reveal the rich source of all that gold. The hunt for the next major discovery is well underway, and Klondike Gold's shareholders are strategically positioned. Stay ahead of the majors and follow KlondikeGoldCorp.com.
Auron Resources is a copper gold exploration company pursuing the world's next major discoveries. It has seven projects, including two active flagships, Committee Bay in northern Canada and Sombrero in southern Peru. This summer will be one of the most exciting times in Auron's history as the company turns the drill at Sombrero for the first time ever. The project's impressive surface results have identified Sombrero as an analog to one of Peru's biggest mines. Auron is also implementing cutting-edge machine learning technology to unlock its highly prospective gold belt at Committee Bay. Visit AuronResources.com and subscribe to keep up with the company's busy year ahead.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. Really pleased to have Jeff Deist with me once again. Jeff is the president of the Mises Institute, and it's an educational organization dedicated to promoting Austrian economics, freedom, and peace. And, of course, Jeff previously worked as a longtime advisor and chief of staff to Congressman Ron Paul. He has a background as a tax attorney, representing high net worth individuals, partnerships, and corporations. His tax career includes a time in two different big four accounting firms. And I think Jeff is actually enjoying himself more now at the Mises Institute, where I just think life is a little better for various reasons. And I think he's doing what he really enjoys. And if you're fortunate enough to be able to earn a living doing what you love to do, It doesn't get any better than that. Jeff, thanks for joining me again.
Hey, Jay, it's great to talk to you.
Always great to hear from you. It isn't often enough as far as I'm concerned. There's just no way we can be more places than one at a given time. So, you know, I wanted your article recently that you wrote at the Mises Institute, Ray Dalio's Hollow Lament was the name of the article. And, you know, my son Scott, he's seeking to make his way in the investment world, and he's been sort of enchanted by Ray Dalio. He had read some of his books, and I guess maybe more than anything, because Dalio has made so much money, he finds Dalio somebody he'd like to understand and probably emulate. So I'm not sure to what extent. I did point out your article to Scott. I'm not sure. I haven't had a chance to find out yet if he's read it. But I've titled today's show, Why Do Rich Capitalists Suggest the Destruction of Capitalism? It seems to be something that some of these guys like Dalio or Buffett or, you know, some of these guys, these billionaire guys, they get really, really rich, and then all of a sudden they turn into bleeding heart liberals. So how do you account for that, Jeff?
I guess the short answer would be to say they've got theirs. In other words, people need to understand the diminishing marginal utility of money. Mm-hmm. If you're very, very wealthy, you're spending a tiny fraction of your income and wealth on basic necessities like housing and food. And mm-hmm. and also, if you're fantastically wealthy, you're not all that much worried about your children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. You've got mm-hmm. plenty of money to set mm-hmm. them up and secure their future and pay for college and housing and all kinds of nice things. And so if you're a billionaire, just a single billionaire, not a deca or centibillionaire like some of these guys. Well, I don't know if we have centibillionaires, but we have decabillionaires. If you just have a single billion and you lose 90% of all your income and wealth to some sort of government redistribution scheme, well, you've still got $100 million. You're still a financial elite. You're still quite set. Whereas the poor average Joe with $400 in his checking account is utterly dependent on his next paycheck for immediate basics and necessities like rent and food and gasoline in the car to get to work and that sort of thing. Now, of course, there's a lot of degrees in between that. Let's say someone's fortunate enough to have $20,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 in the bank. Well, mm-hmm. the loss of a job would not be an immediate catastrophe for that person. But nonetheless, the loss of 90% of their worth would make them basically dependent on government and mm-hmm. their employer. So that's really the difference. It's all about diminishing marginal utility of money. And so when you reach a critical mass, which I would add all of these gentlemen did under our current tax and regulatory system, it's interesting to me that they would now change that tax and regulatory system in a way that would prevent a lot of other people from ever becoming as successful as they were. And so I'm struck by the fact Mr. Dalio here in particular, who by all accounts, exceedingly brilliant, super competent in his line of work, would now turn around and give or argue for giving more of his money to government or to the public school system where he lives, where he's making a big donation. Mm-hmm. You know, organizations that, unlike the businesses he bought and sold and turned around, have no accountability, no share price, no investors, no skin in the game. But are just bureaucratic monoliths that exist in perpetuity and have the police state backing them up. So it's what I termed his latest writings a hollow lament. I meant to say that he's being hypocritical, that he's being tone deaf, that his problems are not our problems, and I'm not interested in a rich guy's argument for big government.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it may keep a lot of people from succeeding, I mean, not a lot, but keeping other people from achieving that level of wealth. But my concern, Jeff, is more on the middle class and what this sort of tax, because it seems as though whenever we have taxes that are raised, the big guys don't even pay that many taxes necessarily. They find ways to, you know, ways within the law to avoid paying as many taxes. But even if they did, as you point out, in that case, in the case of Dalio, he's so filthy rich that if he lost 90%, he's still very, very rich and no problem. I mean, if he wants to, so you're saying he's giving some money to the local schools in Connecticut or wherever he lives? I think it's Connecticut.
Right.
So he can take his own money and give it away. That's help others. God bless him for that, I think. I mean, my way of thinking is, let me, Jay Taylor, do with what the excesses I have to take care, first of all, of my family, my own family, and then maybe the neighbors that I love and care for, or people around me that my life touches, that I care about, that I know. But put a gun to my head and tell me to send money to government, which wastes most of it anyway, and then find me a little trickles down to some needy people somewhere. It infuriates me, and I think most people who think about it, easy enough to give other people's money away, right? So now, can you talk a little bit about how and why capitalism needs to be reformed? That was the article that Dalio wrote. Essentially, can you go over some of the points and how is he specifically, what are the policies that he would put in place to make the world a perfect place?
Well, that's just it. The policies or ideas he outlines are so incredibly vague and so derivative and so unoriginal. I'm shocked by a guy as bright as him. He's lived in the performance world for so long, he doesn't know how to adjust to the non-performance world of government, it appears. But it was full of vagaries. This article is, well, we need better leadership. Well, really? We need people who are better at government? I'm not sure that's the case. And he says, well, we need more bipartisanship. Okay, well, we haven't gotten that, though, over the last 30 or 40 years. And then he starts talking about metrics, which, of course, don't exist in government. They exist in spades in the capital markets and private businesses where people actually lose money and lose their shirts. And then, of course, he has some very bland recommendations for redistributing income and wealth. But my question here is, again, this tax system he now purports to advocate, which presumably involves higher rates, you know, what would have happened if that had been in place for the last 30 or 40 years? People mm-hmm. like him, rich people generally get rich off of capital gains. In other words, they right. buy and sell things, and capital gains have historically in the United States been taxed at a lower percentage, a lower level than ordinary earned income, the average mm-hmm. guy making a paycheck. And so if all along Ray Dalio and his funds had been taxed at 70%, let's say, instead of 15% on all the buying and selling gains they'd made over the years, perhaps he would never have achieved a critical mass of wealth that would enable him to today be a benefactor. Maybe mm-hmm. he'd just be like the somewhat well-to-do businessman who makes $400,000 a year and flies first class mm-hmm. instead of being a billionaire who owns airplanes and companies. Yeah. So it's hard to say. And again, it smacks of this idea that, like, well, now that I'm fabulously wealthy, let's throw some impediments in other people's way. When in fact, it's good that he's wealthy. By all accounts, he didn't earn his wealth illicitly or harmfully, and now he can give it away. I think that's mm-hmm. fine. But I don't want to hear him chastising people like me who argue for lower taxes. For how about on that mom and pop who own a couple of dry cleaners or restaurants and have a $2 million net worth? How about we lower their tax burden so they can become set for life? How about them?
Mm-hmm. Well, even if he doesn't give his capital away, if we had functioning markets, if we had functioning markets, if capital were allowed to be, if price discovery were allowed for capital, which I would argue it is not now, then Dalio's money would be going to work somewhere in capital, as capital that would be used to create more research and development, more jobs, more wealth, essentially. More wealth-creating activities. But I guess maybe one of the problems that we're having, I believe, and I'm quite sure you'll agree with me, is that we don't have price discovery because of the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve has really not allowed us to price capital. That's the kind of thing that maybe Dalio would touch on that sort of thing, I don't know. But we always hear the liberals talking about this redistribution of government has to get in to fix things instead of going back to the basics, like let's get back to free markets so that scarce resources can be allocated efficiently. Let me ask you this, Jeff. How do you think, how would Ron Paul, your ex-boss, or any number of economists, or you yourself, propose fixing the problems that Dalio is suggesting need to be fixed?
Well, first and foremost, we would identify the single biggest driver of inequality is the Federal Reserve. mean, Dalio, to his credit, he does point out that the Fed policies have generally favored rich guys like him over wages and workers. And so he understands that, but he does not understand, or at least he doesn't admit to the degree that his own wealth was driven by the Fed, that it was created by the Fed. I mean, this is a guy who probably would have been successful in any walk of life, in any endeavor, a brilliant, hard-charging guy. I take nothing away from him. But the point is that interest rates have been so artificially low for so long that hedge funds like his have been borrowing money and buying companies with lots and lots of leverage to not too much equity. So this leverage buyout model has made him very, very wealthy, probably fantastically wealthier than he would have been without the Fed, without basically a rigged monetary system. So it's made him rich, maybe so rich that it makes him blind to it. So the number one thing we could do to create a more level playing field is to, as you said, allow price discovery, because the whole idea of hedge funds is to allocate capital to better and higher uses. If a company's underperforming but it has value, the idea of a hedge fund is to go in there, buy that company out, replace the management, shake things up, and turn it around. And I would argue that that is a noble and useful activity for capital in society, something that trickles down and helps everyone.
Yes.
But the manner in which Dalio and other hedge fund managers have been able to do this with cheap money, almost house money, has dramatically misaligned things. It's distorted things. It's made a lot of businesses look good on paper when in fact they don't work in reality. And it's made people maybe it hasn't created a class of undeserving rich, but it's made a class of rich people richer than they would have been.
Yeah, as you point out, Dalio probably could have been successful at anything, but with cheap money, with the easy money, much too much of it flying around, distorting the markets, obviously, it's bidding resources, intellectual resources like Dalio and others. And I've known personally people, Chen Lin, who's a friend of mine, for example, could have gone to Princeton in an aeronautical engineering program, to get his PhD. But he was making so much money in the equity markets that he said, "I'm not going to do that." I've learned to know other people too, hedge fund managers and the like, who haven't done things that might have been more directly beneficial to humankind. But if those assets or those resources get bid away by a distorted capital markets, then we're all poorer for it in the long run, although some people maybe end up lining their pockets considerably more than they would have otherwise. Well, Jeff, let me ask you, and for people who want to keep track of what's going on at the Mises Institute and listen, you have a lot of great programs on there. You host something every week, I think. Is it called? It used to be Mises Weekends. I think you're calling it something different now. Is it?
It's called the Human Action Podcast. Yes. It's an in-depth dive into Austrian economics and current events. So we're trying to apply principle and academic structure to what's happening in the real world.
Yeah, I think that's really good, and I need to start paying more attention to what you're doing. You do have economists on there. I saw recently, actually, I think it was towards the end of last year, you had Daniel Lacalle. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Yeah, Daniel Lacalle, great Spanish economist who's really, really active in Europe.
And this would still be available on your website. The Biggest Bubble of All was a show that you had, a discussion that you had with him back in October of 2018. Essentially, could you sort of summarize what his thesis is?
Well, his thesis is that the scariest bubble out there is corporate debt, and that the American public and the Western public and that the investing public hasn't quite yet recognize this, and thus it's perhaps not already priced in to some of these exuberant market valuations we've seen over the past few years, and that people need to understand that the debt problems at the household and individual level, at the business and corporate level, and at the governmental level have all gotten worse, not better, since 2008 and the crash. So it was a very interesting and sobering discussion of how much corporate debt is out there sloshing around, and yet for a lot of companies it still continues to trade at pretty low interest rates. I do see that Netflix which is a company that makes no money and has an unholy amount of debt, is now starting to be bid up on its bond debt, almost not into junk bond territory yet, but it's getting up into that 7-ish% range. So there's risk, there's money to be made perhaps with great risk out there. But it's interesting to me to see, I don't know if we still use the term blue chip, but to see a dominant U.S. company like Netflix, which is in millions and millions and millions of houses all across the country, nonetheless struggle to make money and finds itself in a precipitous situation, having to issue more and more corporate debt at higher and higher rates.
It's Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org is the place that our listeners should go to. There's just an awful lot of material there. A lot of articles, and also a weekly. Jeff, you host this weekly, this weekly podcast that is excellent. There's some of the others that I saw that really look interesting. Why Socialism Persists. This is one that I think you did on your own. Why does it persist? I mean, here we have, you know, example after example of how socialism always seems to end up in poverty for the masses. There may be a small number of people who get filthy rich, but the rest always suffer. And yet, we just keep going back to it again. What is it about the human species that causes us to do the same thing over and over again and never learn from the past? And in specifically with regard to socialism.
Isn't that interesting? Because people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are thought of to bring new ideas to Congress when, in fact, your ideas are ancient. And they've been thoroughly disproven both in theory and in practice. Ludwig von Mises literally wrote the book on socialism by that same title in 1922, which is just an absolute demolition of the economic program of central planning. So I think the short answer is that there is an element of human nature that likes something for nothing. And of course, it's hard for people to understand, because it's only in government and economics where we find that oftentimes doing nothing beats doing something. Mm-hmm. And I think as humans, we're hardwired to prefer action over forbearance. And I think that psychologically, intellectually, the idea of, you know, something beats nothing, the idea that someone has a program or a plan, always sounds good to us. It sounds activist, like we're doing something to improve the world, even if it's making it worse, in effect, because we have this idea that, you know, that we have to act. And in almost every walk of life, other than politics and government and economics, in almost every other walk of life, you know, action beats forbearance,
mm-hmm.
right? Being proactive and doing things and planning
sure.
and plotting and working and striving mm-hmm. is a good thing in almost every human endeavor. But that's the last thing we need in our political and banking elites. And this is just very hard for people to come to grips with. They want government to do something about X, Y, and Z. And oftentimes the best thing for government to do is nothing, and mm-hmm. in fact stop doing things altogether.
Well, somehow our founding fathers sort of had that inclination for sure. I'm wondering, it's really encouraging to me, and I wasn't quite aware that the Mises Institute was doing this, but you know, obviously for intellectuals, for people who really care to understand economics and how economics really works, not the way they've been indoctrinated to think they work. But Mises and the Austrian School of Economics, that's what the Mises Institute is all about. I'm really encouraged to hear what I think I heard you say a little bit ago, that you're really, your guests are really out there trying to connect the theory with the real world. Do I have that right?
Right. That's really what economics is supposed to be about. It's supposed to help us understand the world. You could say that about all sciences, but it has failed to do so, I would argue, in the last 50 years or so. In other words, economics has gone astray, and we've lost it to mathematics, to modeling, to statistics, to psychology, to a whole host of fields that aren't really economics at the end of the day. And what I fear is that not only are modern economists at places like the Fed and in the financial press, you know, not helping us better understand the world, they're actually misleading us. They're helping us understand the world less, not mm-hmm. more. And they're not predicting anything. successfully. They're not modeling anything successfully. And for all their talk of empiricism against theory, all the empiricism in the world didn't much help anybody in 2008. So I think we find ourselves in a time where economics is trying to reclaim itself and trying to reclaim its spot as a needed field, as a vital field against all the hyphenated studies and sociology and psychology. So economics is in a tough spot. And I would say that our part of our goal is to help improve what economics is out there and to promote what we consider correct or sound economics.
Well, it's certainly anybody that's taken the time to examine Mises and Austrian economics, I think, will be able to see, unless they've been so thoroughly indoctrinated by Keynesianism and the other isms out there in the universities, if they just the common folks can understand Austrian economics to a great extent, because it is so much in touch with the way the world really works, not the way somebody in academia thinks it should work. And it seems to me that what's happening more than anything is that this idea that I don't have to do anything, government will take care of me, something for nothing, is really very regressive, and it causes societies to go down the tube, it would seem. Jeff, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us. I just wanted to mention there's so many other people there, Mises.org, and is it every Saturday? You update it on the weekends, right?
Generally, yes. We do a Human Action podcast once a week. You can find it via YouTube or iTunes or Stitcher or a variety of outlets, and also you can find it at Mises.org, our website.
That would be the best place to go. Jeffrey Herbener, The Theory of Interest Rates, March 28th was one I looked at. Joe Salerno, who I'd like to get on my show sometime. Mises and Nationalism, which would be a good topic. I'd like to hear what Joe has to say. I didn't have time to listen to it. There's so many things there. So, folks, I hope that you'll go there and familiarize yourself with the Mises Institute. Thanks, Jeff, for being with us. We'll look to do it again sometime soon.
Thank you, Jay.
All right, folks, that's all the time we have. Next week, David McElvaney will be my guest, and Michael Oliver probably will be with me, and probably another guest to be named later. Until then, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
StrikePoint Gold, trading under SKP on the TSX and STKXF on the OTC, has a market cap of under $10 million. StrikePoint is a new player in the Golden Triangle of BC in Canada. Focus will be on drilling the Willoughby Project in 2019. Prior drilling delivered over 20 meters of 25 grams per ton gold and 184 grams per ton silver. Recent receding glaciers have identified new gold targets. Neighboring projects have been acquired by StrikePoint's largest shareholder, Ascot. Eric Sprott and Skeena round out the other top shareholders.